Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
So happy to welcome back Andrew Jasko, returning guest. I guess this is your third time. Thank you for dropping back in to Mindshift Podcast.
It's a pleasure.
We just said a minute ago before we hit record, it's been well over a year since we talked last time. I can't believe it's been that long. There's a lot of stuff that's changed, I guess, in both of our lives. But yeah, you were doing a PhD program at the time we talked last time. What's changed in your life?
That's right. Now I'm a marriage and family therapist trainee. So I'm under supervision and seeing clients. And I'm working independently doing a religious trauma coaching program to help people who feel psychologically traumatized by their religious beliefs to heal and recover the sense of power and to regain a healthy, authentic connection with spirituality on their own terms, whether that's atheism, agnostic spirituality, or just open, whatever, that deep sense of connection to oneself and purpose in the world. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm doing. And I decided too, I wanted to get a PhD in something else, probably in Eastern philosophy. I'm really fascinated by philosophy in general. So that's what I'm up to.
Study. Yeah, you got a lot going on.
There's a lot. Yeah, you can never get out of school.
That's true. I think my wife, she always accused me of being a professional student. I was in, you know, undergraduate degrees for years, 14 or 15 years. It's just shocking how much money you can spend, how much time you can spend just getting that next degree, So yeah, it's crazy, isn't it?
It is.
So you're doing all this stuff on religious trauma syndrome, or RTS. I have found in my own life, I've talked about this on other podcasts, but as I've deconstructed and then tried to reconstruct, as you say, rebuilding, regaining a sense of identity and self, I have discovered that the more I go back into my past and the stuff that happened to me growing up, really in a fundamentalist, I would say a cult in the Seattle area, you uncover more and more and more. So there's always something to be working on. You think, oh, I'm over that now. Actually, no, I'm not. So is that must be a common experience that you deal with your clients.
Absolutely. And it's something I deal with in my life too. And I have a feeling that I will be, you know, probably in 20 years from now, I'll come up with something and be like, oh, that's where that comes from. Right. So, you know, healing is a lifelong process. It never ends. And we can always deepen it. But I think we can make really significant headway too in a short amount of time, or shorter, if we really know what we're dealing with and how to target it, which is part of my work. Unfortunately, not that many therapists or healing professionals have training or exposure to these issues. So for me, I don't know if people know my background at all, but just really quickly. So I'm a former Princeton Seminary educated minister. And I had to leave my religious faith and community because of the psychological trauma I experienced. I realized it had given me an anxiety disorder. It crushed my sense of self-worth. I felt anxious, depressed, low self-esteem, and powerless. And like, I didn't know where I belonged. I didn't know what I believed. So I left my career, left my community, started all over. And now my clients hire me to heal and reclaim a healthy and authentic connection with spirituality. So yeah, that's the work that I'm doing now. And you asked that, like, what's something I'm working on? Definitely, I realized recently perfectionism. Like, I was very attached to success and to making this grand impact on the world, right? And one of the issues that people deal with is accepting purposelessness in a way, or just being okay with the mundane stuff and not needing that massive thing. Another thing that I'm really working on now is my empathy with fundamentalists, because I really, you know, it's easy to just be angry and to hate. But that's part of the stage, is dealing with your anger because you've been wounded and hurt. And it's important to feel that and accept that. But now reintegrating that and saying, you know, I was a fundamentalist recently. What can I appreciate about these people that I love? And like, how can I relate to them? How can I be of service?
And especially if obviously we got friends and family member that are still in the religion, whatever it might be, it could be fundamentalist Islam or Judaism as well. It's not unique to Christianity, is it? Maybe we could wind it back a little bit and say, okay, what actually is religious trauma syndrome? Because I've talked to Dr. Marlene Winnell, Laura Anderson, Janice Selby. These are people who are counselors, therapists, who have done a tremendous amount of work around RTS. What's your unique take on religious trauma syndrome?
Yeah, really great people, by the way. I definitely owe them a lot from what I've learned. But so, yeah, let's take a step back and talk about trauma. It's a word that's thrown around a lot. So trauma, I would say, is a wound that isn't healed. It's something that we experienced in life, or maybe not one experience. It could be at just a prolonged environment of neglect and something that we couldn't handle. It overwhelmed our psyche, some kind of experience that was so painful and difficult. There was no way for us to deal with it in the moment. So we dissociated, we left our experience of that. And what happens is that that traumatic event or prolonged event, it's never processed. So the energy of that harm, that emotional overwhelm, it stays trapped in our bodies, in our minds, in our system. And it comes to us in flashbacks or intrusive memories or just being in panic, scanning our environment constantly for that threat, because our system wants to protect us and make sure that that thing never happens again. But trauma, it really leaves a wound. It's like a part of ourself was never able to form or develop and is still stuck in that traumatized state. And our psyche forms, compensates by covering over that wound and kind of developing and doing its best in spite of that to work with us and to protect us. So I would say, in my opinion, things like PTSD, anxiety disorders, depression, aren't really disorders in a sense, because they're ways of adapting that are beneficial, that we needed to survive, that you actually needed. So healthy people develop disordered ways of being that are adaptive to their survival until they can find a way of healing.
I was going to say, I'm a big fan of World War One, and I think a lot of that comes out of the early pioneers in psychology and psychiatry, didn't it, with the whole shell shock phenomenon. That was something that was really a new thing. And psychiatrists studied these veterans. They were just debilitated, weren't they? Because as you say, they were so overwhelmed by their experiences in the trenches of World War One that their bodies kind of shut down, or their mental faculties shut down. How do they bring these guys back? Isn't that where a lot of this kind of started as far as trauma in general?
It is. Yeah, that's some of the origins of trauma work and dealing with PTSD was actually in the wars, like you were saying. What happens with trauma, too, is something called reenactment, or the repetition compulsion, it's referred to in psychology, is that these situations keep appearing in our lives over and over again, these painful situations that we want to avoid. And it can almost feel mystical, like, how is this thing just keep happening? But there's a way in which we find ourselves in these toxic relationships or these abusive or dangerous situations. And part of that is that our psyche is looking for a way to resolve that trauma. So the wound in itself contains its own key to healing. It's like the symptom is speaking to us. And so what we tend to do is try to suppress the trauma. We try to numb out the emotions through addiction, even through spiritual and religious practice. But a way to healing is to actually take that wound seriously, not as a disease per se, but as an ally, as something that can lead us to resolve that. And some of the medicines for healing trauma are compassionate, non-judgmental, loving awareness. So bringing in empathy that we didn't have in that moment into, say, the memory, or even we don't need to remember the traumatic incident, but just to be able to hold that part of ourselves in a different way and to integrate the trauma. It's essentially integration work, because it was an experience that was unintegratable. It was overwhelming at the time. We might have been young. We had no way of dealing with or integrating it. So what we can do now in our adult selves, usually with a healing professional, it's a great idea, but even by ourselves, is when we have those traumas come up, being able to not run away from them, but to welcome them with empathy and non-judgment, and to have some way of making meaning of that experience, of putting it into perspective and context. And then that trauma starts to fade in our experience. It's still something that wasn't good, you know, but it's something that we're able to integrate it, and we're able to move forward in our lives.
It makes sense. So, like the classic example I think everyone would be familiar with is sort of the Vietnam veteran or someone who survived a traumatic, child abuse or a woman who's been raped or something like that, where something can then trigger that person. The Vietnam vet hears a helicopter flying overhead and just immediately snaps and they're back in the jungles of Vietnam, or the person smells a smell that their attacker or their abuser, maybe they're a cologne or something, and that bam, that triggers them. What relationship does that play with this issue of trauma as far as triggering?
Well, that's exactly it. It brings up that original traumatic event or series of events and conditions. And it brings up the same response that you had when you experienced it, or usually panic. Panic is the general, and panic is an emotion we have when our survival is at stake. We've got to fight, flight, or freeze. That's what panic does. So that's what happens when people are faced with that. And if you can get people into a space, a healing empathic space or mindset, where they're able to work with that panic and slow it down enough where they can access what happened, then you can start to do the healing work, the empathic, non-judgmental awareness, finding a way of viewing that in an empowering way of seeing yourself coming through it and growing from it, and really beginning to resolve that unintegrated state.
So that makes sense as far as like PTSD and combat veterans or abuse victims or something like that. What about the religious trauma syndrome piece of it? Why should religion, of all things, be a problem? I mean, I thought, Andrew, I thought that religion was a good, benign force that was helpful. Now you're saying, wait a minute, religious trauma? What are you talking about?
That's right. And I don't want to universalize either. I don't want to say that religion universally traumatizes everyone. And my goal is not to deconvert or convert anyone. If you're religious, if you're fundamentalist and you're saying that's working for me, but I have some issues with this, then well, let's work on that. Okay. But it definitely can and often does traumatize people in very significant ways. And the thing about trauma, or not even necessarily trauma, you could just say psychological harm and conditioning, right? It doesn't have to be PTSD. It can still be severely debilitating. One of the biggest traumas people say is not being seen and not being loved. Because as a child developing, if you don't feel like you need your existence to be validated by another, and if you don't feel seen and if you don't feel loved, it's like you don't exist or your survival is at stake. So within fundamentalist religion systems, you are not loved unconditionally. You're loved positionally and conditionally. Positionally based on how you relate to God in the community, and conditionally based on obedience and belief, not unconditionally. So you're only seen based on your performance and your belief. So this can be very traumatizing for anyone with cognitive dissonance, for anyone who's questioning or doubting their belief, because it's like, am I seen or am I loved? And also, like, assurance of salvation, teachings, especially about hell and judgment. I think that hell is probably the biggest trauma because it's so ingrained in the system and it's such a severe fear. And it's taught, people are given these presentations of hell, fire, and seeing these plays like Heaven's Gates, Hell's Flames, of potentially burning forever, or you never really know if you're right with God. You never really know. There's always ambiguity whether or not you've confessed your sins or whether you're elect or not elect. You can't really tell, right? So this is an insanely crazy kind of thing to live under the constant threat of eternal torture, and it traumatizes people. I mean, I know I had trouble falling asleep every night. I was afraid that I would wake up in hell and burn forever and confess the
Same
sinner's
here.
prayer obsessively, compulsively. So this is one of the more significant traumas. And that's something that I work with people, especially intensely in the coaching problems, because it can be debilitating on so many levels. What people deal with here is the what if question. What if I'm wrong? What if there's just a 1% chance that I'm wrong and then I'm screwed, then I'm going to hell. So it's not worth it. Even though I know cognitively that this religion thing no longer makes sense to me and I see the abuse, that small tiny chance keeps people in this loop of fear and trauma about hell.
And I've talked about this in other podcasts. I had religious trauma syndrome from rapture anxiety. That was a big one. In addition to the hell piece, as you say, I was raised in fundamentalist Christianity in the States, and I believed it from day one. I mean, I just accepted it all as true. My parents said it was true. The pastor of the church whom I trusted said it was all true. It was in the Bible as well, which is the word of God. It's infallible, inerrant. There's no way out in that system, is there? You're trapped. And I developed kind of like maybe what you're describing, religious scrupulosity, where I was just obsessing about every thought, every deed, every action that could end up me losing my salvation. And as you say, going to hell. So I prayed the sinner's prayer thousands of times too, every night, just to make sure. And what does that do to a kid, a young child, developmentally? It's got to be hugely damaging.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is something I cover on my blog. I have an article devoted to this topic called Hell PTSD. Mm. And so I really go in depth into it. That's a resource on lifeafterdogma.org. But it's huge. I mean, it's hard to overestimate the implications of something like that. It's as severe as you can get in terms of psychological, spiritual, emotional abuse. Being threatened with burning with fire forever based on having aberrant, unsanctioned thoughts or emotions or behaviors. Most of them are just healthy and normal, you know, and just for being exactly. A human being too, just for being born into the human condition. So it's severe. And like you're saying, the rapture, sense of judgment. So regarding hell, one of the things that I work with people with in this is the sense of risk. What if this is true? The what if? So people make it into an issue of logic when it's not really logical per se. So like risk is not a category that applies if the thing doesn't make sense to begin with. Mm. So what's the risk that an elephant will fall from the sky and destroy my house right now? You know, what if that's possible? Well, I mean, it could if it made sense, right?
Sure. Flying circus.
So I mean, we could think of something more ridiculous than that, right?
Yeah.
But so it has nothing to do with logic. What I ask people is, what is your reason for believing in this? Is there a positive reason for believing it? And what we find is that there's no logic. There's no there. It's just trauma. Trauma is the reason for believing in hell. And fear is the reason. The threat is the reason. But there's actually no positive, good reason to believe in it. So what we find there is that we're actually just working with a negative. We're working with there's no positive proof. So we're actually dealing with an emotional, sub-rational process.
Right.
And it has to deal with working a lot with that, as well as the rational, as well as just the laughability of sheer insanity of it.
Yeah, the elephant. What about this issue of being hurt by other Christians? This is something that's unique to Christianity. I don't know about other religions. So you've talked about the theological beliefs that could be trauma producing, but I was thinking while you were talking about the belief system in the church, it's notorious for Christians hurting and harming other Christians, whether it's sexually, emotionally, you know, in other ways, spiritually. What about the trauma? Do you find people that you deal with have also been traumatized by their church experiences too?
Definitely, definitely. I mean, these belief systems are so reductionistic and simplistic, and psychological harm is embedded in the system. There's no room for black and whites. There's no room for gray. There's no room for learning or questioning. It is the way it is. And it doesn't account for the complexities of life or human psychology. So you end up with people who are emotionally stunted and developmentally stunted, and and dealing with all these beliefs that are really harmful. So it's inevitable. And the hypocrisy and the disillusionment is a big thing too. What people often find is there are these huge promises of the fruits of the spirit and living a victorious, transformed life. And they find that doesn't necessarily pay off. There's disillusionment with like, I am not this victorious person. Actually, I'm really anxious and really depressed. And there are all
wealthy
people who are judging me. I mean, judgment, right? As terms of hypocrisy. Yeah. So people who are just doing all these things that don't align with what they're saying, and then they're judging you for it. And then they're judging you for being sexual or judging you for listening to rock music, whatever it is,
anything.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anything.
What clothes you wear, anything.
Because they can't love you unconditionally, because God in that system doesn't love you unconditionally. It's all about your adherence to the group, the norms of the group.
It's so toxic. And that's the thing, is that I think now, okay, Christians, the garden variety evangelical, they're probably a genuinely nice person, good citizen, work hard, blah, blah, blah. But they're part of a system that is toxic. And they themselves might be dealing with RTS. They may have suppressed it. But yeah, I wonder, do you find that when you talk to people, these things start to come out that they may have suppressed and then thinking, I'm fine. Actually, no, I'm not fine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would say that anyone who believes in this kind of ideology is fundamentally afraid, whether or not they're aware of it. And they'll claim not to be aware. They might not be aware of it, but it's not possible to seriously believe in the doctrine of hell and not to be terrified on a subconscious level, at least, because otherwise you don't really believe in it. I mean, eternal torture, that could happen to me. I mean, that's terrifying.
That's huge.
So people might have, the lid might be over that with some kind of assurance of salvation doctrine, but it's still there. There's still the threat implicit even within the teaching that you're maybe not elect or you might be able to lose your salvation. So actually what happens, chaplains report this, that a lot of times Christians are on their deathbeds and they're terrified of dying because they've never actually dealt with their fear of death, because it's always been just washed over. You're all good, you know, and then these existential doubts and questions start coming up then. And it's also evidenced by anyone, pretty much everyone I know, at least, who leaves these religions once that assurance doctrine lid over the hell anxiety is removed, then the terror arises. So it was always there, but now the assurance doctrine is gone. Yeah, so it's there. And they're motivated by fear in fundamental ways. You can see in the way they evangelize, in the way they scrupulously confess sins, and the fear is there.
And I think too, someone said the other day that the role of apologists, people who are into apologetics, is not to necessarily convince the non-believer of the truth of Christianity. It's actually to convince the believer that they're believing the correct things. That's a majority of why I read books like Josh McDowell, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And I was a big fan of Dr. Walter Martin, The Bible Answer Man. And it gave me a real sense of assurance. Even talking to Frank Schaefer the other day, his dad's books, Francis Schaefer's book, when I was a young evangelical, I thought, okay, here's a guy who really gets it on an intellectual level. This is not just pablum and spiritual platitudes. Francis Schaefer, I felt, was really an intellectual who really could sink your teeth into this thing. So it made me feel really good about my faith. And I was just, now I see it as, well, that was just giving me assurance that I felt I needed to calm my own cognitive dissonance, apparently.
Yeah, that's right. And people do the same things with giving their testimonies and sharing about the victorious life and the miracles that God's doing in their life. So it's like, oh, okay, this is actually working. This is working on some level. I can attribute this to God. And so then I can swallow the whole camel, which is what is done. I mean, and it may, it does have real benefits.
Sure.
I don't think it behooves us to say that this is all bad. It's not benefiting people in any ways. It is. It definitely is in major ways. But the harms are there too, and part of the hook for the harms is the benefits.
Coming up in just a few minutes, we will return to the second half of my chat with Andrew Jasko, returning guest here on Mindshift Podcast. I don't know about you, but I am finding this episode to be particularly helpful. If you, like me, were raised in a religion, fundamentalism, or in a cult, or if you joined one later in life and then left, now you're looking to rebuild, restore an authentic sense of self. That's what this episode is all about, dealing with trauma, religious trauma syndrome. And we're going to talk in the second half about some other aspects of this, spiritual bypassing, and some of these other issues that we may have encountered during our time within the religion. And then in the second half, toward the end of the chat, we're going to get into some elements of recovery, what resources are available to you, how you can begin to look at healing and recovery and restoring your sense of authentic self that religion basically stole from us. And we're going to get into a little bit on this issue of spirituality. And in fact, speaking of spirituality, the next episode here on Mindshift Podcast, I've got a really interesting conversation with a guy from the Aran Islands off the coast of Ireland. His name's Dara Malloy. He was a former Catholic priest who went out to the Aran Islands, which is miles off the coast of Ireland. He literally got away from it all years and years ago. And there he's become an expert on what is considered Celtic Christianity. And this is absolutely fascinating, because what Dara Malloy is trying to recover is a sense of wonderment and a sense of spirituality, and it has nothing to do with any sort of form of Christianity that you and I may be familiar with, especially if you're coming from the Western tradition. As I was talking to Dara, something I realized is that, and I'd known this for a long time, but it's always good to have this come up in a conversation, and that is that the version of Christianity that oftentimes we are reacting against is the one that we're walking away from. And I'm not saying I'm trying to recover a sense of Christianity by any stretch. I don't think it should be recovered. But talking to Dara, this is a completely different aspect of something that was uncorrupted, and it's much more about spirituality and not at all about the sort of doctrinal fundamentalism that we may be familiar with in Christian expressions here in the West, Catholicism and Protestantism included. And so look for that coming out in a couple of weeks. Really fascinating discussion. The first guy that I've ever talked to that's from Ireland, who's an Irishman. So really interesting talk with Dara Malloy. And I also wanted to give a big thank you to the newest Patreon supporters of Mindshift Podcast. I wanted to say thank you to Portland Norm, who's from my hometown of Portland, Oregon, and Victoria Horton Newman, who comes to us all the way from Tasmania in Australia. We're a little island off the coast of Australia. So thank you to Norm and Victoria for your support of this show and becoming members of our closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group. And it's in there that we do our monthly Zoom calls. And in fact, speaking of which, we have some fantastic Zoom calls coming up in the month of November, just after this episode drops. On the 8th of November, we are going to have returning guest Peter Montgomery from the Right Wing Watch. And of course, this will just be days after the United States election. So we're going to be doing a dissection of what happened in the election. As I'm doing this now, we have just a few days to go before the election. So I'm hopeful that there won't be riots and all sorts of disturbances in the states, but time will tell. We'll see how things go. So we're talking to Peter on the 8th, and then on the 22nd of November, two more former guests. We've got Sam Perry and Andrew Whitehead, who wrote the book Taking America Back for God. So we're going to be, again, I think, dissecting what happened, what took place over the course of the run-up to the election, how Christian nationalism played a huge role in that. And then in December, we've got Frank Schaefer coming back in. That'll either be the first or second weekend in December. So I'm really looking forward to meeting up with Frank again. And I'm in the process of getting his book, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, because we talked about this at the end of our last episode. We're going to come back around and touch on this topic of his belief system. So I'm in the process of reading his book, and then we're going to have a podcast episode again with Frank Schaefer. So some really cool stuff coming down the pipeline here in the months of November and December on Mindshift Podcast. All right, let's get back into the chat with Andrew Jasko as we start looking at what resources are available to you as you look to recover from religious trauma syndrome and begin to rebuild your sense of self. To me, there's another piece to this. Now, you wrote an article a couple of months ago that really kind of changed my perspective on the whole God piece. And what you said in your article was that, talking about some of the Trump evangelical support and all that, I used to say that Christians are being inconsistent with their stated sort of theology and belief system, but actually they're being consistent. That's actually the view of God. Because you could say, okay, well, wait a minute, Andrew. Okay, this whole trauma piece, the church has been perverted. It's been twisted by humanity. And that's where we have this toxic system that's abusing and hurting people. It's not God's fault, man. If we could get back to a pure religion, then we'd be okay. When I read your article, I thought, actually, no, the Bible itself is hugely problematic. And that's got to contribute to this toxic evangelical Christian faith.
That's right. And I think that probably the most pernicious idea in fundamentalism is that of biblical inerrancy. And it's ironic because essentially that's an idol. They're very against idolatry, right? But it's saying that the Bible is perfect and flawless and completely represents God, who is supposed to be mysterious and beyond all comprehension and beyond just a little tiny book, right? And we know it has errors. So you're attributing error to God and sin to God in saying that this book contains no errors. It's just a great, great giant irony. So Christians who are more liberal or who take more of a metaphorical approach can say, you know, there are tons of errors. This represents some of the worst ideas we've ever had about God. So they're able to get beyond that, but because of this reductionistic idea. So anyway, the article is God the Fascist when the Bible teaches fascism and why many evangelicals idealize Trump and the psychology of fascism. And the point is that if we look at the dictionary definition of fascism, the God of the Bible embodies all of the traits of a fascist. Not always, not all the time, but there is a prevalent image of divinity that is a fascist. And it's interesting because it's often conflated with God the Father, God the Fascist, and God the Father. And I argue that fascism often results from a father type wound of not being fathered. And so feeling insignificant, insecure. So you have to bully other people and have this pseudo bravado, this narcissism that developed, because narcissism is really just insecurity turned outward. Just trying to show how great you are because you don't feel great. And that's what fascists do. They're just trying to spread their own ego and use everyone as a means to deal with their own insecurity. And that's what's happening with the fascism we see today. Donald Trump embodies that. And we see these things in the Bible, though. We see racism, God commanding complete obedience on the pain of death, commanding ethnic genocide. All of these kinds of things, and world conquest. I mean,
dominion theology. Yeah,
dominion it's all theology. There. It's all in there. The Bible. It's all in the Bible, exactly. Right?
It is. Yeah. I was just saying to someone the other day, I was reading Frank Amedia, who's the guy, I don't know if you heard of him, but he's the founder of this organization called POTUS Shield, and it's a pro-Trump. It stands for Prophetic Order of the United States. And these are like Seven Mountains Dominion theologians. And he was saying that when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died recently, that basically God put her to death. And he was proud of the fact that God had cleared the way for the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett. And he basically said, look, God's a steamroller. He's rolling over people. And he cited a bunch of verses from the Old Testament where God destroyed the enemy and went in and slaughtered the Assyrians and the Egyptians and all the rest of it. And I thought of your article when I read that quote by Frank Amedia. I thought, this is what Andrew was talking about here. He's touting God on a pro-violence level and saying, yeah, he's kicking ass here. And that's the God we serve. So watch your back, man. You better watch out. He's exulting in it.
Right. You know what? A phrase comes to mind here that an interesting guy said, you strain out a gnat and swallow a camel, you hypocrites. Because that's what's before. Happening. That's what's happening is they're neglecting the weightier matters of the law, like love, justice, caring for the oppressed and poor. Yeah.
What about
and
that?
Just focusing on a specific interpretation of abortion, which is not even biblical, by the way. There's a precedent for abortion in the Bible. There's not a clear answer on that. But just these little things, because, again, this fascistic ideology is within the Bible. So what they have to do when they make the Bible God by saying it's without error is that we have to obey all of it and all the contradictions. So they're loving and good and serving the poor on the one hand and then oppressing them and destroying them on the other hand, because both are in the Bible and you have to do all of it.
You've got to hold all those intentions somehow. So you've got all these people that are leaving the church. And I don't know what the statistics are. Certainly among millennials over the last 4 years, they're fleeing the church. They're leaving the church never to return. They must be dealing with religious trauma syndrome. And then we've got people recently, I've gotten emails and messages from people on Twitter saying, I was raised in People of Praise. And this whole thing with Amy Coney Barrett is hugely triggering. It's bringing up all this RTS. So what about that? What about all this? It's coming full circle. The whole Trump support, the chickens are coming home to roost. You've got more clients to deal with, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, all kinds of things are being triggered right now. And so into some of the healing work, we talked about some of the hell and some of the traumas with that. I think the biggest core issue here is religion's assault on the self. It's a religious identity disorder, and it breaks down your self-esteem, your self-worth, you're worthless, you're totally depraved, you're sinful, you know, woe is a wretch like me.
Original sin. Yeah.
Original sin.
It's all
and
there.
It's all there. So your sense of power is broken, and you're taught to outsource your power and outsource your humanity, your critical thinking, your intuition to authority, the authority of God as it is mediated through the church and their particular view of scripture. So what happens is this breaks down your ego. Part of psychological development is having a healthy sense of self and a sense of your personal boundaries, what differentiates me from other people, from the outside world. You have an undifferentiated sense of self. There's a merger with you and the ideology in the church. So people have trouble thinking independently and saying no to the church and yes to themselves, and are often just always asking for advice, having trouble making any independent decisions or trusting their thinking. It's just always like having to outsource because we've been trained not to trust ourselves and not to find our own sense of yes and no and our own power, just this very powerless state. So part of the healing work is being able to find your yes and your no, your inner voice, your critical thinking, your self-esteem, accepting your feelings, learning to think from yourself. And a big one is responsibility, accepting responsibility, because we're trained in passivity. So like waiting on God, right? Just praying and waiting on God. God's will, right? But can be really disempowering and paralyzing in a way, because there's nothing you can do. So what happens when people leave is often they feel abandoned and powerless and paralyzed and overwhelmed by having to take adult responsibility. You know, the answers don't fall from the sky anymore. But actually what was more disempowering and gave you less power and responsibility was waiting on God and not being able to act. Now you are God. You're your own God, right? Mm-hmm. Everything that was outsourced to God, you have to do for yourself.
You're responsible now.
So that can be an overwhelming thing, but ultimately it's empowering, but it takes a process of learning to trust yourself, having small successes, healing the wounding of no self-esteem, no self-worth, and really, really rebuilding that sense of self.
Do you find that there's this correlation? Reading Dr. Robert J. Lifton, his work on cult psychology, and he talks about this idea of doubling. And he says, for someone who enters into a religion as an adult, later in life, never having a religious background, they experience this weird psychological thing called doubling, where their authentic self kind of coexists alongside their religious self. They have to take that persona on, and they sort of become a split personality in that sense. Mm-hmm. And when they leave the religion, they've got to go back and recover that sort of authentic self. And then in my case, I realized there's a whole different persona where those of us that were raised in it, we weren't doubled because that was our only self. We only ever had the religious persona. So now when I left religion, I don't even know who the hell I am. You know, it's like, I've got to completely reinvent myself, you know, from scratch.
Yeah, that's right. That makes a lot of sense. In psychology, now we've come to view people and personality as having multiple self states. Basically, so coming to view ourselves as having, there's something called internal family systems. It's a treatment modality where it's like you have a family of personalities inside of you. Yeah. And so integration and healing looks like not denying those, because that's just going to deepen your confusion and issues. It's actually listening to the voice of each and putting them in conversation. So, okay, here's my traumatized Christian self saying I'm not good enough. What we want to listen to is what's the emotional truth that that part of us is speaking. So I don't feel loved. I don't feel good enough. Okay, now we can answer that with our adult self, with our loving self. And then there might be something that's keeping us from facing that. That's our resistance. And we want to listen to that resistance. You're trying to protect me here. We want to actually appreciate every part of ourselves, including the ones that we're uncomfortable with or that we don't like, because they all have a function. And to be integrated, we need to get familiar with what we're working with.
So you're working on putting together a workshop. That was why you contacted me the other day and said, hey, I've got so much to talk about. I've got all this stuff in the works. Is it about helping people deal with healing around religious trauma syndrome? What are you actually working on now with that?
Yeah, that's right. It's going to be going over a lot of the major issues and giving some general kind of proven suggestions, powerful suggestions that help. There's also the spirituality component, which looks different for different people, whether you call it spiritual or not. Yeah, so that's going to be a free webinar. I don't have a date for it yet, but I can keep that updated. That'll be on my website, on my mailing list. You can sign up for my blog. Yeah, so that's what that's going to be about.
So what have you found to be sort of the biggest helpful piece around dealing with this RTS issue for people? I mean, I know that's a big general question. Obviously, there's not just one simple answer, is there? We're very complex. We all have different experiences and backgrounds. What have you found, I guess, maybe to be the most helpful?
Yeah, it's hard to find one thing, but I can pick one.
Pick one.
So we already talked about the hell and the trauma. Yeah. And I think relating to the parts of yourself differently, like we just touched on that a little bit, but really being curious about what's going on. Not a lot of people mess up when they just try to change a behavior without realizing and getting curious about why we're behaving in that way. Because we get into these states of overwhelm, and then we think that's the problem. Like, I'm overwhelmed, I'm depressed, and I'm anxious. I've got to deal with that. That's not the problem. That's the voice of the problem. The problem is underneath that. There's a reason why that's happening, even if you're not aware of the reason. There's a reason. And we tend to jump to psychiatry in our society. We're kind of trained to view this as all disease. And that can play a role. That definitely plays a role. But I think we tend to bypass the psychological process a lot of times when we say, you know, I just have a depressive disorder. When there's very frequently something else there. So a big part of the equation here is working with emotions, reclaiming the ability and the right to feel what you feel. This is a huge, huge issue within fundamentalism. It valences all emotions as good or bad. And our society does that too, but it trains us that emotions can be crimes of emotion. Or bordering on sin or actual sin. So feeling envy is bad, fear is bad, guilt and shame are bad, right? And they could be dangerous. They could throw you into hell. So what do? You've got to get rid of that. You can't stay with that thing. I mean, it might be okay to be angry for a little bit, right? But don't stay angry. And what does that do? That doesn't actually work. That just suppresses it and pushes it down and makes it worse. So I would define emotional health as being able to embrace the full range of emotional experience and being fully present with ourselves as we experience life and actually integrating everything. So when we cut out or suppress our emotions, we're actually cutting out ourselves within that experience. So we're denying and repressing a part of ourselves, a necessary part of ourselves. And each emotion has a purpose. So anger, for instance, helps us gain a sense of a boundary that has been violated. And it gives us the emotional energy to address that boundary violation. So if we don't experience anger, we're going to have problems. And not only that, positive emotions are not always appropriate. If I'm feeling all good and blissed out and just happy and content, and I'm in a survival situation, that's not a good thing, right? You want that panic. You need that fight or flight. So it's really, really toxic when we view our emotions as negative and as sins and needing to get rid of them. Really, they are allies. So viewing our emotions and our pain and our traumatic expressions as allies that will help us to heal.
And I remember you talking about this in our last podcast, even though it was a year and a half ago or something. You were talking about suppressing sexuality, which, of course, if you're going to suppress your emotions, certainly in the church, the purity culture and all that, people are suppressing their normal, natural sexual drives, their sexuality, especially around this issue of the purity culture. That's got to be hugely damaging as well to your own development, especially as kids growing up in a church context that's emphasizing this purity culture.
That's right. I mean, it's pretty crazy. It's pretty self-evident. I mean, it's basically training in sexual self-hatred. Or even self-hatred, because sexuality is a key component of being a human. It's not this separate thing. It's integrated with all of our being. It's not like we actually have, these are categories that we make, saying our mind, our feelings, our bodies, right? But it's all one thing.
Yeah, so, you can't just excise that part.
Exactly.
Cut it out.
Exactly. But that's what we're taught to do.
Yeah.
We're taught to metaphorically and spiritually castrate ourselves. I mean,
it's crazy. It literally is. The damage it does.
It's so damaging. And, you know, when people get into these early marriages out of desperation because they just need to have sex, they expect it all to be glorious and loving, amazing. Because you waited. You waited for the one, right?
I was a virgin,
so
man.
It's going to be so great all of a sudden. And what usually happens is people, it's like, oh, now I have all this guilt and shame and dysfunction. And I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Well, it can lead to sexual dysfunction and all sorts. You've built it up in your mind for years and years and years. But then a lot of them, they don't even know what to do on the wedding night because no one's ever taught them even just the basics of sex. So yeah, it's hugely damaging, isn't it? Well, and I was thinking too, we were talking about triggering. This is something I've learned too, that triggering is not necessarily something that you have to view as a negative all the time. I used to say to myself when I was triggered from something from my past, oh my God, I'm debilitated. I'm devastated. And someone taught me that, no, you need to turn that negative into a positive and say, actually, this is a sign that you're growing. This is a sign that you're actually viewing the world differently now. And rather than saying I'm debilitated, let's take a step back and unpack what's triggering you, what's going on there, and sort of work through that. And rather than just getting yourself blindsided and you know, being destroyed. So I think for me personally, that's been a hugely helpful piece in this whole rebuilding of your identity.
Yeah, I think that's such a great insight and so critical.
Hmm.
I would say if we want to use the idea of original sin, ironically, the original sin is telling people that it's bad to feel bad or that these are bad things. Or what the original sin is, so to speak, is people unconsciously living out their wounding and their trauma and not resolving it, because that's kind of what the fallen nature results from, like all of the damaging and the bad things that happen is because we're not able to process our healing and go into these darker areas, what Carl Jung calls shadow work. It's not bad. It just is. It's just part of the human condition. And the sooner we're able to accept it and take responsibility for it, the better our lives are going to be. So like what you're saying, being triggered is really when something, some kind of unconscious material comes up in relation to a situation. So it's more about you than it is the other person, even if the other person is doing something awful. You know, your reaction is a sign that there's something within me that, whoa, right? And so it's such a great tool for growth. It's such a great tool for getting to know yourself and to becoming that better version of what you want to be, to having less blockage and less obstacles.
Now, there's this last piece we haven't talked about before we go. We need to talk about this issue of spirituality. As you said, you mentioned a couple times that it's going to look different for everybody. Not everyone's going to find that path, I think. Now, for my wife, for example, okay, we both walked away from the church, but she's really gone into researching and delving into spirituality. And that's become a huge piece for her. For me, it's not as critical, I think, because my mind, I work more in like research and I'm into like discussing theology and politics. And that's my way of processing, you know, talking about dominion theology and Christian nationalism and all these other things that are going on right now. But what do you find in terms of spirituality that's a helpful piece for some people, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. And just a little before that, this is just a sampling of the issues that we work through. And everyone has
tip of the iceberg.
Everyone has different things. Like what I find is also that people's own specific psychological makeup and their other traumas, all their other life stuff, makes them more susceptible to some of the things within the religion. So we work through that too, because none of these things happen in isolation. So your childhood issues are going to come up. Everything's going to come up. And then there's like grief work that we have to deal with because of the loss that's happened and the anger that's a part of that. So yes, spirituality. This is, I think, something that what I mean by spirituality is a sense of deep connection to ourselves and to the rest of the world and the power and meaning and purpose that comes out of that connection to something that transcends our sense of self or our current cognitive understanding. And so that can look a lot of different ways for a lot of different people. But what are described as spiritual or mystical experiences really happens to people regardless of what they believe, regardless of the metaphysical implications. Like, people are having these experiences. So what does that mean for you? What makes you feel connected to a sense of awe and wonder and creativity and inspiration that's not solely the rational Western dualistic kind of frame of mind and expanded states of awareness and consciousness? I think that this is a really critical part of being human as well, but we tend to be afraid of it, and for good reason, because we've been abused. We've been spiritually abused, mm-hmm. and we've been disillusioned with it. So I think that there are some harms that we can be aware of to be avoided. One of them is known as spiritual bypassing. And what that means is basically bypassing a certain aspect of your humanity or life and using spirituality as a means to escape it, as an escapist.
Oh, yes.
Right. And we see that.
I've done that before.
We did it. Yeah. We did it in Christianity big time.
You just described my whole church experience.
The world, the world and its pleasures, right? Oh, yeah. Wealth, yeah. Money, pleasure, sexuality, all of that. But what a danger that happens in all forms of spirituality, or just in general too, just for anyone, is we try to avoid the harder aspects of humanity. So we try to avoid moral complexity and intellectual ambiguity often, because it's difficult to not have a tight, cohesive worldview and to have these things that don't make sense. So mm-hmm. if we have the Bible and we know everything, it's neat and tidy.
Nice package.
It's difficult, right? And it's difficult to deal with sexuality and healing and all of that. So what can we do? We can go pray and meditate forever, right? And just avoid it all. And so for me, if I find myself outsourcing my power, avoiding my humanity through spiritual practice, it's not necessarily what I'm doing that's unhealthy. It could be unhealthy, but it's that tendency within myself to want to avoid it and not face it, my resistance to my human experience and to my pain. And so an integrated approach to living is saying, is my spirituality integrated with the rest of myself? Is it benefiting my humanity? Is it contradicting my intellectual knowledge? So being able to hold and integrate all of these aspects, I think, is crucial to not falling into that similar kind of harm.
Integration, harmony, and balance. These are some of the values, I guess, I've been hearing sprinkled throughout your conversation. That piece of integration, isn't it? It's finding that balance. It's got to be a healthy balance, isn't it? Anything can become a danger or a problem. It's having those tools to be able to, as you say, process it and critically think about it. What am I getting myself into? Because we know, for example, people who leave cults will oftentimes will just jump into something else that's mm-hmm. equally as controlling, or another yeah. group with undue influence.
And you know what? Another thing is that within fundamentalism, when we come out of it, we tend to define ourselves by our beliefs and by how right or wrong we are and get self-righteous about that. Right?
Oh,
it's easy to do. It's so easy to do. So now I'm an atheist, or now I'm spiritual and not religious.
The angry atheist.
I've done this. I'm very guilty of this. You could see this in some of my writings even. Like, that's something I've had to process, is judging other people and being self-righteous about whatever it is I believe. So we don't have to define ourselves by our relationship to any belief, and we can always grow and change that. And hopefully we will change our beliefs as we grow and have new experiences over time. But for me, spirituality is really, really helpful. I would say essential for me is being able to connect to non-ordinary states of consciousness, states of awareness that transcend an intellectual, egoic way of being, what people will describe as things like ego death, or just these different realms of conscious experiencing that for me have really broken open the secular materialist paradigm and expanded it, not contradicted mm-hmm. science. So I'm really exploring non-dualism, and I find it really compelling in a lot of ways as it makes sense of science, as well as a lot of my mystical type experiences, transpersonal psychology, Jungian psychology. There are really a lot of people who are taking these things seriously. But if that doesn't appeal to you, what I'm concerned most about is having that way of connecting to a deeper place within yourself and connecting to the greater whole of humanity and nature in such a way that gives you power to face your trauma, that inspires you to get a sense of purpose and live your life, really.
I like what you said about that. You don't want to give away your power. You don't want to be disempowering and giving that to someone or something else. And that's not healthy either. Well, I know you do a lot of writing. You mentioned your website. How can people find your work, and where's the best place to get a hold of you?
Yeah. So my website is lifeafterdogma.org. You can find me on Facebook. There's a link to my calendar there. Says you can schedule a free Transform Trauma into Power session. So in that session, we'll talk a little bit about what you're struggling with. I'll help give you some clarity and support. And if you want to consider working together for a coaching program, that's something we can talk about too. But no pressure, just to give you some support and clarity if that isn't something that appeals to you. So you can find a ton of free resources, blog articles, videos on that website too. I just, you know, I want to help any way that I can.
Yeah, that's great. And I know, as I said, that article you wrote on God the Fascist, that really helped clarify some things in my mind, and the pennies kind of dropped. So I do appreciate your writing. I know you post up every so often. You're in our Closed Mindshift podcast Facebook group, so we do have a bit of a banter now and again. Let's not make it a year and a half, though. Next time.
No, and one thing, too, I want to say is that power is the other side of trauma. People who have experienced trauma have a lot of potential for tremendous power and purpose, because trauma forces us to go to a deeper place beyond our current idea of who we are and what we can do. This overwhelming thing that we're dealing with that we could never see our way out of. And it forces us to be tremendously resourceful. And you could say tap into even a spiritual place, a deeper place of wholeness that is bigger even than this overwhelming thing. And what often happens is when people resolve that, it's like a key, almost like a testimony in a way, but not in a religious sense, that it's something that they can give back to the world and other people and find this new level of strength that you wouldn't have had without the trauma. So the trauma is never good, right? But there's something that can be gained from having gone through this experience. It's not all lost. You didn't waste your whole life. There's often that feeling, all my life was robbed from me. There is that loss, but there's really something beautiful, I think, that can be gained too.
Absolutely. I appreciate that point. You have to validate those experiences and feelings. We did go through them. I spent tens of thousands of dollars in, you know, fees going to Bible college and seminary. Where's all that money? Well, I could just be angry and bitter about that. But as you say, what I feel like I'm assigning meaning to it by using the academic skills and the research skills that I learned in academics to do what I'm doing now. You know, so I don't see it as a complete colossal waste. I did for a while, but I mean, it's not my career anymore, but I still use those skills. So I feel like I'm assigning some meaning to it and getting some value out of that rather than just being angry.
That's amazing. That's great. And I really appreciate all the work that you're doing. I mean, I benefited from it too. And I would also say that it's easy also to stay stuck and paralyzed in this state. And I'd really encourage people, you know, whether it's through my program or a therapist who's informed or someone else that you've had on, to really target these issues in a specific way, work with a healing professional. You don't have to stay this way. Like, people do heal. It is possible, even if it feels impossible.
That's a great way to end it. Thank you so much, Andrew Jasko. I've absolutely had a great time. Again, we say let's not make it a year and a half or 2 years or however long it's been. We'll come back again and talk some more.
All right. See you then.